Love doing this.
Hi, I'm Dr. Daniela Stein, and today I'm so excited to have Susan Salinger with me. Susan is the author of the book Sidelined, and is specifically about how women manage and mismanage their health. Susan, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
So, Susan, I'm very passionate about everything that you've been doing research on over so long period of time. I'm a family physician, and I've really seen how women often don't get the health care they need to get. And then even when they realize they need to get health care, it's very tricky for women who are often, we call them in a sandwich generation, where they're either looking after children, or once their children are older, they look after aging parents.
Yes.
So, and you've done so much research on this topic. Your whole book is on this topic. So I'm so excited to be talking to you. I'm going to dive right in. Tell me, why do you find, why do women put others first and not care for themselves?
You know, I think it's the way we've been socialized. I think that we're taught to take care of others and to be nice and to be good. And our job, we're caretakers. We do, I think, I forgot what I've said in the book. I think like 85% of all the caretaking in the world. I mean, that's fat. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And I did find that women put themselves last. In fact, there was a really fun study done where they gave some researchers gave women five items to prioritize. You know, what would they put first? And first all of them would put their children first. Then they put their pet second, which I love.
Oh my goodness.
We were just talking.
Yeah, it is funny. And we were just talking about our pets. You have a poodle, I have a golden doodle. And I can see that, how we even put our pets first.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Then they put their elderly parents, just like you said. So if the dog gets sick and your mother gets sick, I don't know what you do. But there it is. And then fourth, they take care of their significant others. And last, we take care of ourselves. And my point in the book, and seriously, my serious point in the book, is that we really need to take care of ourselves first. Because we do all this caretaking, we have to be in good shape. I think when you're feeling ill or you're feeling badly and you have no energy and you're tired, that really impacts how you take care of the people around you. So if you want to consider yourself a good caretaker, you really need to put yourself first. And that should have been the title of my book, you know. Retrospect is 100%.
Oh, Sidelined is a great title. And then also we often say that you can't pour from an empty cup. So you have to fill your cup first. But we often feel that it is a selfish thing to do, to be filling our own cup when there are so many people around us who need our care and our attention.
Yeah, I think that that's true. In fact, several women told me they feel selfish. And I think in the book, I quote Michelle Obama, who said she doesn't consider it selfish. She teaches herself and her children to always put themselves first. And personally, I do that as well, because I can't take care of my family if I'm off. I can do it, but I don't do it with the same competence and enthusiasm when I don't feel well. I can't. I mean, you know, we're only human.
But then that has also been a journey for you. You didn't just know that, right?
No, I did not. Although, you know, partly I did, because when I'm sick, I'm sick. And, if somebody needs something, I can drag myself out of bed. But generally, I love to give. I'm a giver,
Yes.
And I really like to take care of people. And think about the last time you had the flu or a cold. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's what for me is, generally speaking, a fun thing to do. It became a horrible chore. And so my attitude changed as well as my energy level. I think that's what I'm saying.
That's big. And then also with all your research and wisdom, you know, you've walked this journey. I haven't walked, a lot of my patients haven't walked. So yeah. It's so valuable for me to learn. And then, so, because we are often quick to put off our own care. And then once we do realize that we want to get care and we end up in our doctor's office,
right,
That is a big thing I'd like to talk to you about. Why is it that women often feel that they would offend their doctor and not really getting the, not asking the questions they should ask? Okay, will you talk to me about that?
Well, you know, I think it's in some ways similar in the sense that we, again, women are socialized to be nice and we want to be good patients. We want our doctor to like us. I mean, I think that's just a sort of a gender difference. I think men have I did minimal research on men, but I did do some, and they have a different agenda. They go in and they're much more objective. They see it as their illness or their symptoms as a problem that they and the doctor are going to solve together. And women don't quite do that. They go in and they look at the doctor sometimes as an expert. Sometimes they look at the doctor, he or she, as a colleague, but much more rarely than men do. And I think that I think it's a cultural thing. And I think it's also changing. I think that women now are much more in a take charge mode and much more empowered, not only because of my book. I should be so lucky that many would read it.
But that is your goal with your book, right? Is your goal is to help women to take charge, yes, and to be aware of that, because we are often not aware that we're just people pleasers.
Right. You know, so I think I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, but I think once we become aware of it and we can't treat a problem if we're not aware of it. So if you're aware of the fact that you don't have to just go in and please your doctor, you know, that equips and enables you.
Well, in fact, you know, there's one of the most important chapters in the book actually is getting second opinions and why women hesitate to get second opinions. And it's all for the reasons we've been discussing. But in terms of being a nice patient, one woman said to me she would never get a second opinion because she would feel that not only would it hurt her doctor's feelings, but that she felt that she would get a black mark against her on her chart and that would follow her sort of throughout her medical journey. And that is an unfortunate attitude. Mm. What I didn't understand, and you probably know this, I mean, as a doctor, of course you do, but I didn't realize how many diseases there are out there. And I've been reading that there's between 20 and 40,000 diseases, and those are the ones we know about, and that many of them have similar symptoms. So for a doctor, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that for a doctor to make a diagnosis, I mean, unless the symptoms are obvious, but it's like, it can be like looking for a needle in a haystack. And so I also think that as everybody does, we see what we expect to see, so that the same symptoms can be stressed to a psychologist or stomach issues to a gastroenterologist. And so I think it's really important when your disease is serious, if your diagnosis is serious and your treatment is serious, I think it's critical to get a second opinion. And not many of the women I interviewed did not agree with me.
That is quite interesting, because I would get second opinions when I do my kitchen renovations and someone asks. I get a lot of second opinions for a lot of other things.
You know, that's a wonderful line, and I'm going to be quoting that in future. Really, I will, because you're right. We don't hesitate when we get bids for a kitchen or a whatever. You know, we check out our obstetricians, whatever we do.
Yes, and then even if your diagnosis is then confirmed, then it's still a journey about your treatment options.
Yes.
Because there are different treatment options for different people. And it's not necessarily that the treatment option in front of you is the best option for you, because every person is different. So even if we have the correct diagnosis, we have the top five treatment options, then each individual might find, say someone has high blood pressure. For the one person, it is a good idea to just go onto medication. For the next person, might want to go on a low salt diet, and that might make a significant difference. The next person, if they just maybe quit a stressful job, their blood pressure would instantaneously be back to normal. For someone else, it might be weight loss. For someone else, it might be walking. You know, for each type of illness, there are different treatment options. Yeah, so it's important to open that conversation, to continue to have that conversation, for sure.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've learned a lot since I wrote the book, I mean, by doing the research, but I always ask for the clinical name of my diagnosis of my disease, and I always ask for the clinical name, or the real, not the generic name, of my medication, because I want to look it up. I go home and I look it up and I make sure that things match. And, you know, you really have to, I can't say take charge because, of course, we have to listen to our doctors. But, well, I'll tell you a quick story where I just had a sore thumb. And because of my book, I'm one of those, you know, I was sure that I had cancer of the thumb or something. It never occurred to me that it could be anything less than that. So I went to a hand doctor. And she said, you know, she said you have thumb arthritis or whatever it was and prescribed some painkiller. And I got the name of it. And I said, well, you know, I'm on Lexapro for depression and stuff. Is there any connection? Is that a problem? And she said, no. There's no interaction whatsoever. So I thought, great. And I took the prescription and I went home and I looked up the drug she'd given me. And she was mostly right. There was, but there is a connection 1% of the time where you can get a brain bleed.
Oh my goodness.
So 99% of the people don't. But if you're the 1%, that's a pretty crappy situation, particularly over a thumb. So I just threw out the prescription. My thumb got better. But my point is, if I hadn't looked it up, I could have been taking a risk for something that was really not that serious. It was just my neuroses, you know.
That is a good example. And then taking care of your own health, I think it's a very good way to describe it. It does not mean you're going to ignore what your doctors say, but it does mean that it really opens up that conversation that you are in control of your own health. No one else is as invested in you,
right,
in your own health. Right. So I think it is a valuable point to make that we all have to take control of our own health and see what things we can do to improve our health. Your thumb, for example, is a good example. When you know it's osteoarthritis of the thumb, you can really look at it. You know, what are the other things that can be helpful to reduce the inflammation in your thumb?
Right.
So it is, and see what are the things that you can do. There are things your doctor can do, but there are things that you can do to take control of your own health.
Right. And I think that that is where a lot of women fall down, because in a certain sense that comes under taking care of yourself first. You need, and it's hard to do when you have young children. I mean, of course, I'm older. My kids are older at this point. But and when kids get older, I mean, 7, 8, 9, it's a lot easier to put yourself first than 1, 2, and 3 kids.
Sure.
You know, it's young kids take a lot of time. I get that. But still, it's also they also take a lot of energy. So, again, it's really important to take care of yourself. It all goes back to the same thing, you know.
Yes. Yes. And then you talk about a bit about how some people might believe that their illness could be a punishment for past behaviors. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I was very surprised because I don't, personally don't do this, but how many women blamed themselves for being sick? They thought it was their fault. So many of the women I met, and I mean, well over half, maybe even 75%, blamed their illness on stress. And they were sure that the reason they got sick is because they were so stressed and they just couldn't manage their stress. They couldn't manage their lives. So they saw their illness almost as like a news flash, a flash to the public. Look, I can't manage my life. You can see that. That's why I'm sick. And I felt very badly about that because I think that we forget how random illness is. I mean, I always say, look, some people get COVID and some don't. And some people, you know, have arthritis and some don't. It isn't necessarily your fault. And just so many women did not see it that way. I tell the story about my father-in-law who never exercised, you know, hates vegetables, ate nothing but red meat, did all the wrong things and smoked a cigar daily, if you can believe that. And his blood pressure was so much lower than mine is. And I do all the right things. I mean, it is what it is, you know. And I
agree with that. As someone who specifically practices lifestyle medicine, I tell people that you can be in control of your life. You can do things to make you better. But yes, then on the flip side, so on the one hand, I do believe that stress can worsen illness. But
yes,
then I do think it is important to, once you do get that illness, not to have that guilt on top of that, because that's not going to make you better.
It's, no.
You know? And well, for some people,
it makes it worse.
Yes, it does.
Because now you have to take care of your emotional side.
Yes.
You got to glue yourself back together emotionally as well as physically.
Yeah. And then you also say that this whole emotional aspect of your illness, you know, people often talk about the emotional. What have you found in your research? been?
It's so funny you ask that, because one of the controversial things I found, or conflicted things I found, I guess, is when women go to the doctor, we describe our symptoms so completely. We tell the doctor how we feel about it. It's not just a sore throat. A man would go in and say, I have a sore throat.
Yes.
A woman would go in and give all of the how it makes her tired and she can't do this and go on and on and on. But yet when women get a diagnosis, or a prescription, and I interviewed, this is particularly true of the women I interviewed who had hysterectomies, it never occurs to women, or we're so anxious for physical relief that it never occurs to us that there may be some emotional side effects, particularly with something like a hysterectomy, where your hormones can be involved. You know, that's a whole different thing. And so it's just really interesting to me. I feel that on the one hand, we focus on how much our mind and body are connected, but yet when it comes to the treatment, we just want the physical relief and we completely put our mind on the back burner. Mm. You know, I got to tell you this because it was so fun, but there were some really fun studies done where some researchers wanted to talk about and prove, you know, the mind-body connection. Yeah. So they took two groups of students and they put them in two different rooms, and they gave one group some hot coffee and the other group some iced coffee. And then they gave each group the same fictitious description of a person. I don't know who it was. It wasn't anybody. And the group that had the warm coffee liked the person much better than the group that had the iced coffee.
Oh, interesting.
You know, isn't that fun? I mean, your body really does affect how you think. And I thought that was fascinating.
Yes. No, it does for sure. It does for sure. And so that is quite a big thing. And the specific example you used about the menopause, that's a big thing, because I see the same thing with women after hysterectomy. And then so for some, if we take the ovaries out as well, it triggers instant menopause. So they don't have that gradual going through menopause that other women have. They have it quite instantaneously. And that is, I do a lot of work on menopause. And to me, you know, that is obviously a whole podcast on its own. And I wrote a whole book on that on its own.
Yes,
but that is something quite profound, the whole emotional thing that goes along with that. Yeah, that is, it's good that you raise awareness that women should recognize the emotional connection that then goes with the illness.
So important. Recovery. And again, just to continue the shame discussion a minute, those women that did have a hard time recovering from their hysterectomy, or those that are having a hard time during menopause, not all, of course, but some of the women I talked with blamed themselves. They said to me, so many women have hysterectomy and every woman goes through menopause. Why am I struggling so much? As if there's something wrong with them.
But that's why it's important for me too, because I've noticed the same in my patients. So I think it's so important for me. That's why I'm passionate about having this conversation around menopause, because no, there's not something wrong with you. You are not the only one struggling. Everyone is struggling through this. People are just not comfortable having this discussion on a public platform. So we are often not aware of other people's struggle. And I think that can be very helpful when you know that you're not struggling alone. There's not something wrong with you.
Right. No, absolutely. And I was really lucky, because when I went through menopause, I had hot flashes for maybe 3-4 weeks at the most. You know, I had some bad hair days. It wasn't more serious than that. But when I tell people that, I can see how many people struggle. My own children who are in their 50s are really struggling with menopause much more than I did. And they compare themselves to me, which isn't fair, because everybody's different.
So are you that lucky that your menopause was that easy, or do you think you forgot part of it? Because that's what I often find, and especially with childbirth, I've delivered so many babies, and then while I'm there with the mom in the labor ward, the mom would go through a very difficult delivery, and then when they come for the 1 week, healthy baby checkup, I will overhear how they tell my office assistant or my nurse,
oh, I love that. I can't. I don't know. Wow, I have to think about that. I don't know. I don't think so, but I'm not sure. I think partly, my mother had no problem during menopause either. So maybe there's a genetic factor involved. I mean, I honestly don't know, but I love your question. And I really have to think about that. I remember it. Well, you know, the other thing which I left out, I mean, the backstory is I was thrilled to be in menopause because I know, see, you're one of the... But I was, and I'll tell you why. My periods were always irregular. I never could do when I was getting them. I would only get them, and I'm half serious, when we would go on vacation, when I wore white pants. That's when I would begin to menstruate. So, I mean, this has just been heaven for me not to have to worry about it. I mean, during the summer, I'll get dressed now, and I don't care if my pants are white or not. You know? And I used to, like... I used to worry that I would be in my husband and I used to run our own business, and I'd be worried that I'd be in a conference and I'd be sitting in a pool of blood on the conference room chair, and I had no way of knowing. So I think it's different for women that have that know that their period is like clockwork, you know, that was not me. So the backstory truly is I couldn't wait for menopause.
But then I also find that if you do have that ability, if it was more than 3 weeks and it was more than just hot flushes that you went through, if you do have that ability to forget about the bad parts and remember it not as bad, I think that is a great skill to have. It's and even with myself, when we talk with other people about our kids, I'll say, oh, our kids are so easy and they're sleeping so well. And I would love to have a fourth kid. And then my husband says, like, what? No, they never slept well. And this has been hard and that has been hard. So in my own life, I almost think that it is this selective memory that I have to only remember the good things and have a harder time remembering the harder things. You know, that's what made me able to have three kids. Because if you remember the trickier things, then your body will just say, no, I'm not going to go through those sleepless nights again.
No, I think you're probably right. I mean, I think what is it? It's called repression, and I think it's vastly underrated. I mean, I think it really has some good points to it that we don't talk about. Because I must admit, I do have a tendency to forget about. I only hear what I want to hear half the time.
But what your book really is about is to help women when they are going through the journey, when they are aware of the more difficult things, to really get the healthcare they need. Go and talk to your doctor. If your doctor can't really give you the answer, go get that second opinion and really try to get the answers, right? To advocate for yourself. And that's really Absolutely. What the heart for your book is about, to not be sidelined.
Well, and I think it's important, and I this is something I do want to talk about just for a second. When you go into the doctor, I think it's with your symptoms, I think it's very important to have a written list. I don't mean a list in your head. I mean something written down. I don't care if it's on your phone or pencil and paper. It doesn't matter. I remember pencil and paper, you know. But it's important to write it down, because what that does is, number one, if you're like me, I get really anxious when I go to the doctor, and it keeps me focused. And it keeps the visit on track, and it helps keep the doctor focused as well. I've had many, many doctors who've just taken the list out of my hand and gone down it, you know, with me. And I mean, it's great, because that way I get all my questions answered. And then the other thing I do, as I mentioned earlier, is I get the clinical name of the diagnosis so I can go home and look it up. I want to make sure I'm comfortable with it, that it fits my symptoms. And that's one way I decide whether or not I do need a second opinion. Yes. And then the other thing I do is repeat back in my own words what I heard the doctor say, because, again, I get anxious and I can mishear, and I do mishear. I mean, it's just what I do. So that gives, when I say it in my own words, it gives me a chance to be sure I understand. It gives the doctor a chance to confirm that he or she said what they meant to say and that I heard it correctly.
Yes, and that I think is all so of valuable. Them,
Would you agree with that? Because you're on the other side of the couch.
Yes. Oh, yes, for sure. So on both. So the first one, we actually call that closed loop communication. And we are trained as physicians, as nurses, to do that. So if I tell a nurse, please give this patient 10 milligrams hydralazine, then the nurse reads back to me, okay, so I'm going to give this patient 10 milligrams hydralazine, and then if it's by mouth or in the intravenous.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Now, yes, we call it in the hospital closed loop communication, and it is essential. We get trained to do it. And I've been training my husband and kids at home to do that, because I often say things and they hear something completely different. And then
Absolutely.
Once they say back, yes. So for communication, that is key.
So wait till they're teenagers. You think it's bad now. It's true.
And then the other thing is about the lists. So that is very helpful for sure. Whether I see a patient in the clinic, and even when I see patients in hospital, they would often tell me when I see them, because I just quickly come into a patient's hospital and room and they don't know when I'm going to come in. So that is often startling, because you're like watching maybe a TV show and now your doctor is next to you, and the patient right. will say, oh, I've been thinking about something to ask you the whole night, but I just don't remember yeah. now what it is. So I really encourage my patients in hospital yes. to write that list. And then also for my patients in the clinic, I would often find that in a clinic, patients will talk about symptom A, B, and C. And then after leaving the consulting room, they'll say, oh, and doctor, I've got this mole on my back, but maybe we'll
right.
talk
that's
about that next
terrible.
Time.
Right.
But then when I look at that thing, you know, that's maybe a skin cancer. That's a much bigger thing than the other things we were talking about. So if they had that list and I could scan through the list, you know, I could have said, how about we talk about this thing first, and not
right.
as you're heading out of the consulting room as a add-on, but no, this is the most important thing. We should really tackle this problem first. So yes, for sure, lists are very helpful.
Well, and I think that's such a good point you just made, because I forgot to say it, is don't, whatever you do, introduce a new problem as the doctor is leaving the room.
Yes.
I mean, it's not fair to you or the doctor, you know. It's funny you brought that up.
Yes, because that's a big thing, and I've seen it time and again. So it makes it a little bit tricky if I'm on my way out going to see the next patient. You know, do I dismiss this, go and see the patient? Do I go back into the room? Yes. So I think rather yeah. mention it than not mentioning it at all, but it is often helpful.
Right.
Your problem will get better care if you mention it in the yeah. beginning or while we're both seated having that conversation.
Well, and I didn't think of it, but you're right. If you go down the list and you see a mole, you're going to look at that, if not certainly first, if not second. I mean, something, you know,
yes.
you wouldn't let something like that go by, you know.
Yes. Yes.
Huh, I never went there. That's interesting. I'm learning. I have another point to add to my repertoire here.
And then you said that you felt that drug companies really target women more. Tell me a
yes.
bit about that.
Yeah, that I did not know that. Women make about 80% of all health purchasing decisions. Now that's in the United States. I don't know about Canada, but I think it's similar.
I know we make all the decisions for other things, like household items. That I knew, but I didn't know specifically regarding medicine.
Yeah, and so
makes sense, though.
It's medicine doctors. You're the one that tells your family to go to the doctor, or not you personally, but women in general. But I think what happens is that the pharmaceutical companies, of course, know that. So they target women with their TV ads. And if you'll notice, there's usually a woman protagonist. And she's always, generally speaking, has a kid with her, because they know that women put their kids first. So you'll see the woman being really depressed, and then they take whatever drug is that the company's promoting, and she's suddenly playing with her child, you know, frolicking among the roses. That's a typical ad. So I think women get prescribed more drugs than men do, partly because we have diseases, I guess, that need, I mean, we suffer more from anxiety and depression. And so that we need more drugs. Those drugs are better for that than other things. And I think autoimmune diseases we suffer from, and sometimes those need drugs depending on the disease. So, I mean, there's some good reasons we get more drugs than men do, but nevertheless, we do. And it's partly probably because we make all those purchasing decisions. And I know that United States, you're lucky because it doesn't happen in Canada, but United States and New Zealand are the only two countries in the world where drugs are marketed to consumers. And so because the drug ads target us, 40% of the people that watch a drug ad will take some form of action. So that's
interesting.
I know, isn't that interesting?
Sure.
So as a result in Canada, do your patients come in and ask for a specific drug?
Definitely not as much as in the United States. Definitely not. No, we don't get targeted. We do have more strict rules against.
Yes. You're much better off.
Yes.
We spend more on drug advertising. Drug companies spend a lot more on drug advertising, I think, than they do on development. I have to check myself on that. But it should be the other way around.
Yes, sure. Sure. So that is definitely something I'm going to read up on, because that's really not been something that I ever read on, you know. So how does drugs get marketed more towards women, at which age groups? But it does make sense, you know, what you're saying.
Yes.
Just because if I need any medication, your mom is the first person you would go to when you have a headache, when you have a tummy pain. Right. I often tell my kids if I've worked late at night and I come home, and they tell me that they have a headache and a tummy ache. I'm like, why did you not tell dad? Why? Dad was with you the whole night. Why did you not tell dad?
It's true.
Yeah, it is such a natural response to leave those things to mom. So it makes sense that.
That's very funny. And I think that must be universal, because it happened to me. And, you know, it happens to people I know in England. I mean, it's all over.
Yes, so it makes sense if women have that purchasing power to focus your marketing campaign.
Yes.
Yes.
And they do. They really do target us. And it pays off. I mean, there's no question. You know, something else I didn't mention, because I've talked a lot about research. The back of my book has a whole resource list that I've organized by topic. I've actually done the research for you. So if you want to research your drug, just go to the part of the book, back of the book, where it says drugs, and it will give you some websites to check out. That some of the ones I used, some of the ones I was told. I tried to make, you know, I verified them as best I could. But I wrote the book a year ago, so I don't know what's happened in the meantime. And you never know. But
that's such a powerful resource. Yes. Thanks for that.
It's a very important part of the book. If you want to research your doctor or know if your hospital, well, here in the States, we grade our hospitals. Do you do that? I mean, some hospitals are good for cardiology, some are good for neurology. And you want to make sure you're in the hospital that does the best for your particular surgery procedure. Oops, I just lost an earring. Surgery or procedure or whatever.
Yes, to take that charge of your own health. Susan, you're a big inspiration. Thank you for all the research and all the work you've done.
Oh,
and thank you
welcome.
So much for spending time with me today. I'm sure our listeners would have gained so much. I will put all the links in the description below, and how people can reach out to you, where they can find your book.
Thank you.
Thanks for all the work you've been doing.
I enjoyed talking with you so much. I really did.
Thanks, Susan. And to our listeners, please send us your comments. Tell us, you know, where are you in your health journey? And I really hope we've inspired you to take care of your own health, to get more answers, to really be so involved in your own journey to get yourself healthier before you care for everyone. So to not be sidelined.
I said, that's right. Exactly. Well said. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. Have a good day. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.